Hey, this is Random Ready Savage from Colt 45, and you're listening to the Nerd Podcast Mafia. Entertainment your ears can't refuse.
Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of Superhero Speak.
But I think many of the people that love this character and that love superheroes in general have used these stories as inspiration to say, you know what? I'm going to do something good in the world. I'm going to make a difference like my hero when I was a kid.
That is my fondest memory of it, because when you're doing comic books, you want them to affect people,
right?
You want people to care. You want to strike emotions. And I knew that Clone Saga was striking a lot of emotions.
Can you imagine Pulp Fiction starring Goofy and Mickey Mouse?
I can totally imagine that.
I'm sure somebody's written that one.
Quarter pounder with cheese in France, Mickey? What? Boy, ale with cheese, Mickey. Yeah. I can totally
see.
I would watch the hell out of that movie.
Yes, I gladly sacrifice that my progeny to you, a mighty Marvel beast.
But Neil Adams is somewhere going, it's my time.
How do you measure success?
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And John.
And JD is off this week. He is dealing with lots of snow in Chicago, and we wish him luck. But in his place, we have a really great guest with us this week. Anyone who's ever paying attention to the website saw that we had an interview posted with him a couple of months ago. But now he's here to talk about his book in person. So he is the creative mind behind Sonitis for Alternate Comics. Welcome, Dan Shepard.
Hey, guys. I hope everyone's doing great.
Doing all right. Now that the snow has melted here in Philly, but we're supposed to get more tonight.
Oh, we're just tired of the cold. I mean, the absolute bone-chilling cold we've been going through.
Oh, I hear you guys. It's been miserable up here. Those negative degree nights and mornings are not the best.
No. Yeah.
Although they are fun if you like, you know, throw some water into the air and watch it turn into snow before it hits the ground.
You know, I've seen this trend this year. I don't know if you guys have seen this, where people are freezing bubbles. I'm seeing a bunch of videos of people blowing bubbles and then watching them freeze and hit the ground and roll. And I don't know if this has always been a thing, but this is the first year I've seen anything about it.
That's awesome.
I haven't seen that before, but I might have to try that now.
Yeah, I haven't got a chance to try it myself, but I've been very tempted.
And YouTube. Okay.
Cool. So I'm going to try to avoid some of our usual questions, because you already answered them on the website.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I guess I will kind of start with, you know, how did you get involved with comics? You know, what would you say was your journey, and has this always been something you wanted to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So growing up, I had two dreams. One was to write comic books, and the other one was to be a pro wrestler. So pro wrestling is very much still in my blood. I enjoy it. It's one of my biggest hobbies. But along the way, I did a couple of like the one-day training camp things and realized it was not for me. But the comic book one has kind of always stuck with me. I've been reading comics religiously since I was about 8 or 9 years old. There was a corner store, pretty basic getting into comic store. There was a comic store up the street. I would go up there about once a weekend, once every other weekend with my parents. We'd get some candy and a comic book. And I can remember the first comic I ever got was Spectacular Spider-Man number 248, which was an issue that teases the return of Kraven the Hunter about 8 to 10 years after the events of Kraven's last hunt. Mm. It ended up being his son, for the record. But, yeah, so, I mean, I read comics all through the late 90s into the aughts, and then about 2 years ago, I became very good friends with Cody Souza, who is the writer of Croak for Alterna Comics, and he wanted to work on something together, so together we came up with the idea for Sonitis.
Cool. And, of course, you said in the interview you're trying to not answer a lot of questions about the book because you want it to be mysterious. Before our listeners who haven't read the interview online, there will be a link in the description to it. Just what can you tell us to get people, you know, enticed?
So, I mean, yeah, I definitely don't like to give details of the plot, but I can definitely give an idea of what helped us come up with it and the general tone of the book that we're going for.
Okay.
So I said before we were on the air that, you know, I have tinnitus myself, which is an inner ear disorder that essentially creates a buzzing or a feedback or other such noises kind of in one ear for people who suffer from it. For me, it's combined with eustachian tube dysfunction, so there's a weird pressurization in my ear at all times. I can't pop my ears. Like, if I'm on an airplane, it slowly, like, fizzles out instead of pops. Mm-hmm. So depending on the time of day and how loud or quiet things are, it actually does sound kind of like whispering sometimes. So when Cody and I were trying to come up with a horror comic, I brought that idea up of what if someone was crazy and what if everyone thought someone had tinnitus, but they were actually just insane or just had something actually going on with them. Mm. So Cody combined that with, he kind of wanted to do a traditional haunted house book. You know, he was coming off Croak and he did a traditional style kids in the woods being chased by a monster type story. And he wanted to do a haunted house story next. So we kind of combined those two ideas into tinnitus, which is about a guy who goes to a house in the woods that he remembers from his childhood because he feels a drawback to the house. He's been hearing things in his head. All the doctors push it off as tinnitus, but he knows there's something more, and he feels a pull bringing him back to this house from his childhood. And it's kind of told in three parts through flashbacks at two different points in his life, once as a young boy and once as a teenager, and then the present day where he's in the house again.
Hmm, okay. That sounds intriguing. I'll have to definitely check that out.
It is definitely tough to give too much away with mm-hmm. to give too much in the way of description without giving anything away, which we've been trying to avoid during a lot of this. Cody and I posted a decent number of panels from the book along with the first few pages, but we purposefully have not shown too much ahead of time. The first issue is definitely setting it up. The second and third issues is where it goes kind of crazy. But we're trying to avoid showing as much as possible,
right,
so that people get the full effect.
It's always that fear of, like, when people sometimes describe The Sixth Sense as that movie where, you know, the guy was dead the whole time.
Right, exactly.
You don't want that, right?
Yeah, and I don't know, I will say there isn't a Sixth Sense type twist in the first issue, but how do I want to put this? We feel that if we give away too much, the tone of the book may be, I don't know. It's something along those, I don't want to set up any preconceived notions, people, of what the book is going to be any more than I have to. I kind of want to leave it as mysterious as possible, as you said when we first started.
Right.
Well, I'll just say that if you reveal any more, you'd have to kill yourself, so.
Exactly, yeah. Which, you know, whatever.
So,
I mean, I would reveal stuff, but then I'd be very upset with myself. And
exactly. It's going to get real interesting once we get into trying to market for the second and third issues, though, because that's where we really can't say anything. Issue one, we at least have a little leeway with sharing stuff. Mm-hmm. Issues two and three are going to be even tougher, I think, with trying to keep things under wraps and advertise without advertising, I guess, is the only way to say it.
Right.
So is this helping, I mean, this mysteriousness helping to drum up interest in the project? Or?
That does seem to be the case. A lot of the feedback we've got on Twitter from people who have pre-ordered the book and are kind of following Cody and I while we've been talking about it, there does seem to be this aura about it, at least with this smaller subset of people, where they're excited to kind of see where it goes because we've kept it so mysterious.
Cool. And so the plan is a three-issue arc.
Correct.
Is that going to be 3 months in a row, every other month? What do you know the release?
It's every other month. So a lot of Alterna books, in fact, I don't want to speak out of line, but I believe it's all Alterna books are actually on a bi-monthly schedule. So we are February, April, June, with one in February, two in April, which should be out in solicitations next week, available for pre-order next month. And then issue three will be out in June.
Cool.
And then I think we're going to try and shoot for a trade paperback collection early next year. I don't think we're quite going to try and push it out for the end of this year. Cody is trying to push Croak in trade form later this year, so I think we're going to focus on that. That was a book I was an editor on with him. And then early next year is when we think we're going to push Sinitis for trade paperback.
Okay, cool. And who's doing art duties on this book?
Art duties is Cecilia LaValvo. She is... I've not spoken to her too much. Cody's had more discussions with her. I know English is not her first language, I don't believe, so a lot of that is done through translation and emails. Mm-hmm. But her art has actually blown both of us away. You may have seen Cody or I post stuff on Twitter about how she seems like she gets better every time we see her work. And I know that's a very blanket, generic statement that you hear writers say about artists they work with. But Cody and I were going over recently some of the early stuff we got from early page layouts, and even some of the pages in issue one, moving along to the stuff we've seen recently from her in issue three. And it's almost like she's been doing Arbok on the side, and she's been working on something huge scale that's leveled her up considerably. Because those pages that we're seeing come in from issue three, which aren't even colored yet, are unbelievable. So cool. If you guys flip through issue one and you like her art, wait till you see what she does with issue two and three, because some of it is unreal. You know, we had some of these really, really crazy ideas for some of the stuff that we wanted done in issue three. Some of the stuff, we actually came up with a lot of the stuff in issue three before we even wrote one and two. It was one of those things where a lot of the climax was definitely thought of first. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say I didn't think that she could pull it off, but I didn't think she could pull it off as well as she has pulled it off, because it's pretty crazy.
Cool.
Yeah, she's got a DeviantArt page too. There's quite a collection there, and you're right, her art is pretty damn good.
Yeah, she's incredible. And like I said, I mean, we hired her for a reason. We thought she was great, but she keeps getting better and better. I wouldn't be shocked to see her on something big within the next few years.
She's got a little bit of Eon Flux going there.
Yeah, she does. She's got a lot of the shading and the black she does reminds me of a lot of guys like Matteo Scalera that are working in Image and stuff now too. Just that very, I don't want to call it like a hash mark style, but she does a lot of dark inside of her pencils, which it benefits it so much.
Yeah, I was gonna say I looked at the first on Preview World. They have the first four pages available to look at, and just the style, like what. What I find interesting or what I like is when you're doing like a horror book like this or mystery, however you want to quantify it, the art fits the tone that you're going for. You know what I'm saying? Like you couldn't put, not to say that Jack Kirby wouldn't do a great job on anything, but it's tough to get somebody who's known for drawing these dynamic, great, larger than life superheroes and get them to do something that's simple and stark, and is supposed to be setting a tone of like bleakness, you know, and that's definitely what you get from her art, you know, from the.
No, I totally understand what you're saying. You wouldn't put Scotty Young on a book of this tone.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah, I hear you. Some of the art we saw from her before we pulled her for Sinaitis was not nearly as dark as what she pulled off here. So, you know, we gave her the instruction, hey, we kind of want this book to be dark, and she really took and ran with it in a way that we didn't even expect. I mean, I'm biased, obviously, but I think that cover for the first issue that we've been advertising with, you know, the face silhouette over the house is just very striking. Like, we wanted a striking cover for number one, one that would jump off the shelves. You know, it's tough to get an indie book out there, so if shops order it and they put it on a shelf, we want a cover that's going to draw people's eye, and I don't think that she could have done a better job with the first issue and that cover.
And did she color it, or was that...
It was D. Kniff is the color. Okay. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Cody and
That's
I speak
okay.
about him frequently, but I'm not certain if that is the correct pronunciation, so I am sorry if I'm incorrect.
That's okay. If you're saying it wrong, we would definitely say it wrong. There's no way.
But it's no, and that's also another thing that really sells that cover, too. It's colored just right. You know, it's not overdone. It's just the sunset colors, and it's perfect.
Yeah. But yeah, you caught the sunset really well. This looks really good.
Yeah, she we actually just got, and I know I posted the cover for number two on Twitter the other day, as did Cody. We revealed that. But she actually sent us the pencils and the inks for the third cover last week. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be, it might, I don't know, depending on what we get done with the colors and what tone we decide to go with, it may actually even top the first issue, because it looks incredible. But yeah, this first cover I'm really hoping is kind of a selling point, because I do think that it kind of sticks out even amongst everything else that's going on right now.
Well, that's what they say. I mean, you know, huge percentage of getting a book off the shelf is, does it have a good cover? And, you know, this definitely does, so...
Yeah, I mean, comic books, it's fun. Comic books kind of go against that old adage of you can't judge a book by its cover, because with all the choices you have, everyone kind of has to. You don't have time in the shop every week to flip through every book, so you really got to wow them with the very, very front.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Cool. All right. So we can't talk too much more about the book other than, you know, what we said, because we don't want to give anything away, and I totally respect that.
Yeah.
So is this the, other than editing, is this the first book that you've written?
This is so, yeah, I mean, I have, Cody and I worked on a story in the IF anthology from Alterna. We worked on a 2 or 3 page story for that, but we actually wrote that after we'd written Sinitis. Sinitis has been done for a bit now while we were getting the pencils done.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find with a lot of indie books, they're kind of done well before they're released because of how long the process is when you're paying the artists and you're slowly getting everything put together. So Sinitis was the first thing that I wrote, but it is not the first thing that's technically been published. We did have that story that came out in the IF anthology. It was just a short, like 2 or 3 page crime story that Cody and I worked on, more like an interrogation scene type deal. But that was in, I don't know if you guys have checked out the IF anthologies that Alterna puts out, but it's just chock full of like little short stories like that. So
cool.
It wasn't one that we put a ton out about because you really couldn't do preview images for something that was only 2 pages to begin with.
Right.
So yeah. Yeah, this will be the first longer form book I have out.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't checked those out, but I usually like anthology books, so I probably
will. I'm a big fan of them myself. We're actually, I'm working on a story in an anthology called Death of the Horror Anthology. This gentleman named Kelly Brack is running it. We tried to run a Kickstarter for it late last year. It didn't, unfortunately, was not successful, so we're looking at other avenues for it right now. But we're all pretty optimistic. There's some decent names on it. Ryan Ferrier is on it. There's a couple other people doing, like, not bigger name people, but bigger name people on the indie scene. People who've done stuff for IDW, Boom, etc. Have stories in it. So we're looking to potentially get that picked up somewhere.
You're taking submissions for this too.
Yes. Yep.
So just anybody or?
He was originally like, we started it. I started working with him back on it in, I think, October, I want to say, maybe September. And I know then he was still putting teams together. I do not know if he's still taking submissions on it. I know when the Kickstarter failed, we had lost a few of the teams, so it's possible that there's some other names he's looking to pick up, but I'm not completely certain on that.
Okay. And anybody listening to this, if you want to take a look at that, it's on alternacomics.com/if-anthology.
Yes.
So there's all directions there. Sounds good. It's tempting as a writer, you know.
He does one, yeah. He does. So the one I was just speaking about was actually Death of the Horror Anthology. That's through a separate. That's through a separate company. That's published by Kelly Brack. We're trying to do it through Kickstarter and other stuff. But the If Anthology is something that I believe Peter Cimetti does every year through Alterna, and each year it's a different genre.
Ah, okay.
I don't know what he's planning on doing this year. He's announced it, but I know the idea is that each year it'd be a different genre that he focuses on, which is I think a really interesting concept because it's not. Go ahead.
2018 theme is horror, it says.
Okay. I couldn't remember if he had done horror already, because I know he wasn't repeating stuff. So, yeah, that's solid. And a lot of the alternative stuff that's solid has been horror, so I think that's a great route to go.
Cool. So, John will be writing something, that sounds like, and trying to submit it.
Yeah.
It's okay if you reject them, it's fine. You know.
Yeah. Definitely.
Everybody does.
I mean, I don't know if you guys do you guys know Peter as well? Have you spoken with him?
Just through email a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I would definitely. He's someone I think that would definitely be great to have on the show. And I mean, if you're looking to pitch something, I'm sure he'd be happy to hear it out.
Oh well, maybe I will have him on so John can pitch.
Do it live on there so he can't reject you.
Exactly. That's
Peter, I'm throwing you under the bus.
Comic Shark Tank. That's all we need.
Exactly.
It'll be that shark from the Flash TV show, right? The shark guy.
Killer shark.
Yeah, yeah, King Shark or whatever.
King Shark. That's it. Yep, King Shark.
King Shark.
One of the things I find cool with anthology books, when you try to cram a few different stories into, you know, a 22 to 36 page book, you know, you've got to tell a story and grab a reader's interest within 3 pages, 3 to 4 pages. You know, and I've read some really great short stories in comics, you know. So anyone who's never read an anthology comic, just like the next time you're at a comic book show, see if any of the publishers have one and you pick it up.
I have such an affinity for anthology comics that I would work on them all day. I mean, I grew up with, you know, I they're not anthology comics per se, but I think I talked about in the interview on your website, I grew up with stuff like Goosebumps, where it was every other month you get a new little novel, kid's novel, with a different horror story in it.
Right.
I grew up with You Afraid of the Dark on TV. I loved The Twilight Zone when I was a little kid. So anything that's that anthology style format where it's just each installment is a different story. I'm just in love with that idea. And the fact that for some reason that can't seem to take off in the modern comic industry is a real bummer.
Right. Because, I mean, they used to do that, right? In the 50s and the 40s and the 50s and 60s, you know, all the time. And now it's like, you know, you get Marvel Tales, but it's just, a separate Spider-Man story or Human Torch story. And it's like, no, that's.
Right. And even when they try, I mean, they tried to relaunch Marvel Comics Presents maybe, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, and it ran for 12 issues because it just didn't sell. And even you have indie publishers that try and do anthology type books, and generally they don't sell. I mean, the only anthology I'm aware of that's original content that runs consistently is Dark Horse Presents, and that might even be gone now because I haven't checked it out in a while. I don't even know if that still exists.
I'm not sure.
So, it's a tough market for anthology stuff for some reason.
You'd think in this day and age with the really hyper short attention spans of kids that would take off better than, you know, longer runs.
Right. And it's confusing to me because you'd think there's so much good, like, web comic type content, not even traditional web comics, but just creators who can't get their stuff published who are just publishing it online a page a week or whatever they do. I don't see why there aren't some indie companies trying to pick up those the content's already made. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go through the main process. The content's there. Just sign some of these guys to contracts, put them in anthology books, find a way to make it work. I think there is a market for it, but for some reason it hasn't been discovered in the last couple decades.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great way to present new ideas and get them out quickly to people. And it just, yeah.
I know Image has done a couple anthologies. I think it was Brandon Graham was like kind of fathering some anthology stuff for Image. I don't even think that's still running though. It was a book where like, I think it was each arc was going to be a different story or each arc was like three different stories and each issue had one part of each story in it. But I haven't seen that solicited. I think it was Island, I think was the name of it. And I haven't seen that solicited in well over a year either, as far as I'm aware. So I just, nothing seems to be hooking, but. We'll see. I'm hoping stuff like this. I'm hoping Peter can keep having success with the If anthology and stuff like the one we're trying to get going on Kickstarter, really picks up.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because in the novel world, there have been a lot of anthologies with sci-fi fantasy books and, you know, usually edited by people like Jim Butcher or P.N. Elrod or, I don't think Ilona Andrews did that writing team, but those anthologies seem to be doing well because there's more and more of them coming out, and they're literally like there are authors out there that started very long book series by writing short stories that went into these anthologies. So you'd think with the pictures.
Well, so twofold on Axe. I think you have a great point because even one of my favorite actual book of last year, not comic book but book, was again. Probably butcher the name, Otessa Moshfix. It was Homesick for Another World. It was a series of short stories. I think they were archived off of previous work that they had done, whether it was online or short stories and other novels. But it's just a series of these really, like, mundane but freaky and weird stories. Like, it'll be someone's super mundane, boring life, and each one kind of twists itself until it's this gross, twisted story by the last few pages. And I know it was one of the more critically acclaimed books of last year. It ended on a lot of people's like top books of the year list. It was my number one for the year. So anthologies are definitely still there in books. And second fold, in television, think how many shows now are season-by-season anthologies.
Right.
Where each season it's either a whole new cast or the same cast playing different characters like American Horror Story.
Yeah.
But I feel like every year there's one or two new series that picks up that format and succeeds with it. So, like, you have Channel Zero on Sci-Fi, American Horror Story, American Crime Story, that new show Feud that won a bunch of Golden Globes or got nominated for a bunch of Golden Globes. Each season of that's going to be different. So the anthology stuff's there. It just hasn't clicked in comics yet.
Right. And they're actually, not to plug someone else's thing while you're on, but there is a great.
Please plug anybody's stuff. Comics are great. Plug everyone.
There is an anthology that's coming out shortly. A friend of the show, Troy Brownfield, he's been on a bunch of times. He actually was on talking about this called Terminal. They kickstarted it. They didn't reach their goal, but they're still working on releasing it. They're finding other ways to fund it. And it's a sci-fi anthology. And the cool thing is, like, it's a group of writers working on it. Like, they're all working on their individual stories, and then they're talking to one another. And there are tiny tie-ins with each story, but, like, not really. Like,
it's interesting.
Like, there might be a character in the background of one story that was the main character in another story. Like, he's just walking by. He's not an intricate part of that second story. He just happens to be there, you know.
But it creates kind of a world-building
exactly
inside the book itself. I like that idea a lot. Yeah. What did you say it was called?
Terminal.
Terminal.
Imminent Press is the company they put together for it, to put it out under. So.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds pretty neat, actually. That's the type of stuff, like, in my opinion, that comics needs more of. Because I think that not only am I personally invested in that format of storytelling, but I think it gives so much opportunity for younger people to kind of, people who might not be able to have the confidence to work on a full book or even the platform to work on a full book themselves, right, can get their name out there in an anthology. And I think that's super important. So I think there's that secondary level of importance to anthologies too that can't be overlooked.
Exactly. Cool. So, and also you mentioned Image and you mentioned Dark Horse.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that I put a poll out on Twitter, over the weekend. It's something that we do every week. We put a poll out, so that we can have something to discuss on the show. And, I asked, who is your favorite non-DC Marvel publisher? Please comment if you have a fifth option. And of course, we picked Image and Dark Horse. And, since you were going to be on the show, we said Alterna and then Zenoscope, who's a local publisher here in the Philly area.
Yep.
And, so what I found fascinating was the results. Of course, Image got the most votes at 46%.
Yeah.
Dark Horse was number two. And then Alterna and Zenoscope tied for third place.
Yep.
And, you know, it's interesting because what I find is, like, Zenoscope puts out some really great books, but yet they're not as big as Image, you know? And of course, Dark Horse, I think one of the things that made Dark Horse big was some of the properties they got to work with. You know, Star Wars and the Terminator books and all that. So it's like, I guess what I would ask you, what you kind of think, do you think that that's a bad sign for smaller publishers, or just, you know, it's just all about the publicity. And as long as you guys can keep doing what you're doing, it doesn't really, I mean, obviously you would love to sell a million books, right? But so would Marvel.
Right, yeah, anybody would, I think. I don't think there's going to be anybody that says, I'm content selling 1,000 copies, you know? Right. It's great that people are buying indie books at all, but obviously you want to shoot for the top. I don't know that it's bad. I think it's status quo, if anything. I will admit when I was, you know, in middle school, high school, I wasn't too much into the indie comic scene. I was the Marvel, DC, sometimes Image and Dark Horse guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say right now it maybe is healthier than ever, as far as the number of options people have for indie publishers. I mean, you mentioned those four. I've heard of Zenoscope. I don't know that I've read anything from them, but I know they've been around for quite a while, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least 10 years at this point.
Yeah, I know I've seen them in the previews magazine and stuff, so I definitely recognize the name. But, I mean, I feel like there's maybe more options than ever for independent writers as far as, you know, you can pitch to Image and Dark Horse, but those are kind of the big guns as far as the indie world goes. But you have places like Alterna, Boom, Oni, you know, Vault, Black Mask. You have a lot of these publishers that Aftershock. Aftershock's a little bit different because they seem to only take high-profile creators.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, if anything, yeah, it's split up between all those places. But if all those places are kind of on the same level as each other, when you put it all together, it does make up a decent chunk of what's going on in comics right now. And I think you're seeing a lot of names come from those publishers. I mean, Matthew Rosenberg pretty much came from, I believe it was Black Mask he was putting books out for before he got to Marvel.
Right.
So it's not as though these publishers aren't having attention paid to them. I think, you know, you put in your due diligence, you do your work, you work the hardest you can, and you write the best or draw the best you can or whatever part you're in. And I think the number of indie publishers that are out there is actually better than it's ever been as far as having options goes.
Yeah. So just in the interest of the conversation that came afterwards, of course, our co-host who's not here, today. JD had replied, Valiant, ? And I replied, who? Just joking around. And then
I actually want Valiant, but
One of our followers, Tony C. Mole, really feels like it should be between Image, Dark Horse, Valiant, and IDW. Eh, possibly.
I think so. I'm a huge fan of IDW and Boom, but only because they're putting out what I consider to be IDW, in IDW's case, the best Ninja Turtles content of all time.
yeah.
And in Boom's case, I think that they're doing something with the Power Rangers IP that I've wanted done for over a decade now. Right. Because I love the book that Kyle Higgins is doing for them. So I have some affinity for those two publishers, but it's literally because of those individual books for each one.
And I don't know who runs Alterna's Twitter, but they responded with, thanks for the love, but Boom Studios and IDW should be on this instead, though. But thank you nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, it's Peter.
It
I
is believe, Peter, runs, okay. Runs
there. Yeah, and he's a very humble dude for the most part when it comes to that stuff. But he's doing a lot of really great stuff for indie comics as well. I would love to see Alterna kind of continue to expand over the next year or two. Because his heart's in all the right place, which I think from the little I've heard of some of the other areas of the comic industry is not always the case. But Peter truly is in it to make sure that not only himself, but everybody else gets to the recognition they deserve.
Oh yeah. For the work they put in. I could tell, when we started the relationship and, you know, I just emailed him and said, hey, is there anyone who would want to, you know, do the podcast? And he just forwarded it off to all you guys. Mm-hmm. And I got this huge response back from everyone. You know, I could tell like he's not sitting there going like, oh, let's just send someone over there to see how they do and whatever. Like he does seem like he wants everyone to be equal and have an equal voice.
Yeah. At least providing you're putting your work in. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I mean, he definitely has some standard as far as like, he'll call you out if you're not pulling your weight for your book. But it's in a way where he just wants everybody to pull their weight and everybody to be the best they can with it, which is appreciated a lot of the time.
Well,
and he's never one to be the glory hound or to take everything. You know, I wouldn't doubt that if you send that email to different publishers, that there's a chance that they would just take the interviews for themselves and kind of give it to their two or three highest profile people. But
right.
It is Peter just literally sent it out to the entire message chain that, you know, we get two or three emails a week from him. You know, tips and news and all that stuff. And he's really got his pulse on the entire community of writers and artists that he works with. So we're constantly getting stuff like that, and it's always very much appreciated. Cool. I don't know that he hears that as much as he should, or that the appreciation is shown, but he it's definitely there.
And just to wrap this up, our friends over at the Colt 45 podcast, he responded, and just like that, I realized that I don't know. Well, he used an expletive. I don't know anything about comics. So Brandon, thank you for responding. And yes, maybe you should head down to your local comic book shop and see what indie publishers they have on the racks.
Yeah. I mean, it's so easy to fall into the trapping of just buying stuff from the big few companies, but you know. Crack open that back half of the previews catalog sometimes, yeah. And let a couple things catch your eye, because you'll find a lot of stuff in there that gets overlooked.
Cool. So shift the conversation just a little bit, because one of the things that we do talk about on this podcast a lot is, of course, we live in the golden age of nerd comic book movies. Mm.
And as much as we'd like to hammer you on more details on your comics.
Yeah.
So what do you think of, like, you know, let's say the movies from last year? What did you get to see them all, at least all the comic book movies, and who was your favorite?
So this is actually a fun question, cause it gets into my personal life a little bit. I actually run a movie theater. Yes, I saw everything, some of them long before they came out. That's my real person job is, I'm a senior manager at AMC theater.
Mm.
So I'm kind of in charge of running one of those. stuff like Star Wars, by the second weekend, I absolutely hate them because of how much we're getting crushed by them. But as a fan, I was very big on most of the content that came out last year. The only 2017 comic book film that I think I did not enjoy was Justice League.
Say it isn't so.
Did not enjoy Justice League at all. Spider-Man Homecoming I was a little bit lukewarm on. Spider-Man's my favorite character, fictional character in anything of all time. I was a little bit lukewarm on that one. I thought it was good, but not great. Everything else I highly, highly enjoyed. Logan specifically.
You don't think that the Spider-Man Homecoming was, I mean, okay, maybe lukewarm, yeah, but compared to the last, trilogy and a half?
I will say I absolutely loathe the original Sam Raimi trilogy with a passion. Ooh. I've grown to hate it the more every time I try and watch it. I loved it as a kid, mind you, but anytime I've tried to watch it, like, as an adult, I cannot enjoy them. I liked the first Andrew Garfield movie and thought the second one was very goofy, like very, very poorly made, objectively a bad movie, but I had a fun time with it. I do agree that Spider-Man Homecoming was better than it, though. I still prefer the first of the Andrew Garfield movies, though. I still think that got Peter Parker down the best.
Really? Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, after you. Please.
No, I think there are certain aspects to the way that Andrew Garfield played the character that I could see rubbing people the wrong way, but I think if it's looked at as more of an adaptation of the ultimate version of Peter Parker, he kind of nailed it. I do think that the new kid, Tom Holland, is excellent. He's not really missing anything. There was just something, I think it's just because I really like Andrew Garfield as an actor. I think that version of it clicked with me a bit more than the Tom Holland one has thus far. But, you know, that could change one more movie in.
Well, that one more movie probably being
Infinity War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, who knows how much of him we'll get to see in it, but we do know that they finally reveal his spider sense there.
Which was cool. Yeah, that was awesome in the trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was definitely one of the most clever ways of showing it. Instead of doing the camera closing up on his face or that kind of stuff, it was just like, no, just show him getting goosebumps, you know?
And I think it's cool that it doesn't have to be this big, like, reveal moment in one of his own movies. It's just he's learning his powers more. He has this now. Mm-hmm. Like, it started to trigger. I think that's really cool. It's subtle.
Well, what did you think of Wonder Woman?
I loved Wonder Woman. I thought Wonder Woman was... I kind of hope they continue with the period piece concept for each Wonder Woman movie, because I don't know that I'd enjoy a Wonder Woman movie in the present day as a 2-hour film, but I like the idea of it just taking place in the past and us seeing her at different points in time. And I know there's rumors right now of the second one taking place, I think, during the Cold War, which would be interesting.
Yeah.
So I kind of prefer that. I loved the settings. I loved the costume design. I love her as Wonder Woman. I thought Chris Pine was great as Steve Trevor. The only thing I hated was just, and it's a constant issue with comic book movies, just how generic the villain was. There was really nothing. There was nothing there on that side of it. That's my biggest complaint with it. And that's actually the one thing I will give Spider-Man Homecoming, is I thought that Michael Keaton's Vulture was one of the better Marvel Cinematic Universe villains we got. Still not excellent, but at least he had some distinguishable motivation.
Right.
And he
didn't really monologue. And the Wonder Woman, I mean, they had him monologuing for crying out loud. Wonder Woman.
Oh, it was awful.
The
CGI for him was terrible once he transformed, too.
Well, especially with that face. I mean, Weasley.
Yeah, the third act was really kind of a mess there. The CGI was just distractingly bad. He was awful. But the first two-thirds were excellent.
Yeah, I actually did talk about that in our full review of the movie. It was a lot of the CGI in the third act was just bad, and it was like it felt rushed. And you can tell that the whole thing was the Snyder influence. In the third act, you know, overall it was a great movie, and it finally put Wonder Woman on the big screen. So I think that's
Wonder Woman on the big screens and something better than what we would have gotten in like 2005.
Right.
So
true.
Gal Gadot did a wonderful job. So
unbelievable. Yeah, she's the saving grace of that DC cinematic universe. I don't really dislike any of their casting. For the most part, but she's been the shining star of it to me anyways.
So, speaking of the DC films, we'll stick with that for a minute. And going into 2018, are you looking forward to a solo Aquaman movie?
Not particularly. I love, oh my God, what's his face? Jason Momoa. Mm-hmm, yeah. I think he's great. I am in love with Amber Heard, so I'm all about her playing Mara. But in Justice League, that scene where they're in Atlantis, those water effects were so distractingly bad to me. The idea of sitting through an entire movie of that is not something I'm looking forward to. So I'm hoping that they find a better way to make that work, because one of the big complaints you see about the DC movies is how kind of gray and brown they are. Right, and I thought that was in full effect more than anything during those underwater scenes. And obviously it's underwater. It's going to be a little grayer, a little bluer, but it was almost so muddied and gross looking that I can't fathom looking at that for 2 hours.
Well, yeah. The thing is that if you're going to have bad CGI, there's going to be nowhere where that will be more apparent than trying to render underwater scenes.
Yeah, you're right. Cause it's the whole thing. Yep.
Yeah, so, and we know it can be done well because The Abyss, like, happened, what, almost like 15, 20 years ago, and their underwater scenes were great. I mean, if they stick with practical effects for most of it and, you know, work it well, they could do a good job.
Now, were you guys as distracted as I was by that scene in Justice League, how distractingly bad that looked? Well, or was that just me?
No, and I noticed this before you even said anything, but when I saw the movie, it was the split or the cut between when they were filming him underwater and when they switched to a CGI scene was just, I mean, it was like, oh, we're now in a cartoon. Oh, okay, we're back to, yeah. And you think that with the underwater scenes, when they're doing real life underwater scenes, that they could make the effects maybe a little bit better, but it really did seem like, okay, you know, he's holding his breath, obviously. You know, there's got to be a better way to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm assuming we're going to see it. I think they're – how long before Wonder Woman did we see that first trailer? They actually showed it to us pretty early, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'd say there's a chance we'll see a trailer in the next 3 or 4 months, even though it doesn't come out until December.
Yeah.
I'm hoping by then we see some improvement in those water effects. Obviously, we'll see a lot of them in the trailer, because I don't see them doing an entire Aquaman trailer on ground. So we should have a better idea long before the movie comes out of whether they've fixed the issue or not. But I don't know. I want to be optimistic about them, but they make it difficult.
Yeah. Also, the idea of the magical air bubble so they can talk. Just
are they going to do that every time?
Right, exactly. Like, that just doesn't work, you know. So we'll see. I mean, you know, I've seen it depicted in cartoons and comics and the games where, like, they can just...
It's telepathy or something.
Telepathy, or they're just, when they go into a building, it's not filled with water. You know, they've done it a lot of different ways, but yeah.
Yeah. Look, just take, this could be a reference lost on nearly everyone, I have no idea. But just take a cue from Super Mario Odyssey, and when you swim into the building, all of a sudden you're in the air and you're walking, and you don't have to worry about the water effects. You're done. Like, so.
As long as they have the Mario theme playing in the background, I think we'll be golden.
Yeah, yeah, solid. That'd make for a good Aquaman movie.
And every time he keeps throwing his trident to control the creatures.
I think you actually have something there, because that's not too far off from how Aquaman works anyways, so let's just run with it and make it Aquaman Odyssey.
There you go! Hopefully Warner Brothers is listening.
Yeah, yeah. I just, listen, I'm hoping that, I hate to say I hope anything fails, because that's just overly pessimistic, and that's not how I generally try to operate, if possible. I kind of want them to just fail one more time so they can call it quits and just do like an Elseworld-style thing, man. Just give Ridley Scott Green Lantern with no creative control, all creative control rather, and have it tie into nothing. Just
right.
Give like big name directors these movies where, because I don't think that there's any director that wouldn't want to work on these properties if they didn't have to deal with WB and DC breathing down their throat. So I think you could convince almost anyone to work on a Superman movie or a Teen Titans movie or a Green Lantern movie if you just gave them ability to do whatever they wanted with the characters. And I think that's where DC can differentiate themselves from Marvel, and I think that's the only way that they survive long-term. I think the Martin Scorsese produced and written Joker movie is a start to that, but I think that they need to kind of go more heavily in that direction.
Yeah, I'm a little leery about that as well, but
that particular one I find, like, I'm not super high on, but I think that that's a step in the right direction concept wise is to just do that. But are you, the Martin Scorsese, who's directing it? I forget who they allegedly have directing it.
Oh, I don't remember.
Which one is this? The
Martin Scorsese is going to produce it, right? He's not directing it.
I thought he's producing and or co-writing and producing it, but he's not directing it. I forget who they have allegedly listed to direct it, but that didn't have me super optimistic about it.
I can hear John typing.
I'm trying to find it. Yeah, I guess, the Joker film.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not finding it really quickly here.
I forget who it was, but I know Todd Phillips is what I'm seeing here. Which,
yeah, I was going to say, Todd. That's the first hit I got was Todd Phillips as well.
Todd Phillips.
You know,
that's the dude who did the Hangover movies and War Dogs and Due Date. And I don't know that I need him working on my Joker movie that's produced by Martin Scorsese.
And starring Leonardo.
Yeah. but as a concept, that's what I would like DC to do.
Right.
Is stuff that's on its own and let big name creators handle it.
Well, yeah, but if you're going to do Joker movie, why don't you just go to Quentin Tarantino?
Oh, I totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Can you imagine that?
No, well, he's too busy doing Star Trek.
Star Trek. Yeah. is that a sore point among you guys? I'm not a huge Star Trek person, so I'm not actually sure what the general fan opinion on that is, because Star Trek's one of my few nerd blind spots.
I as a longtime Star Trek fan from like the very beginning, who's seen like all of the series, I'd say that the movies are like the Star Wars prequels. It's okay. Like, you know, or Matrix 2 and 3. It's like, you know, this really has nothing to do with the original source material. And, you know, they literally took the idea that Star Trek is based on, you know, that humans are good and they're striving to be better people, and they're all, it's all character driven drama, and the, you know, the background is literally just a backdrop for the human condition. They took all of that and then threw Fast and Furious into it. it really, I mean, you know, every movie they have Kirk and the cast doing things that they just is so out of character. It might as well not be. It's not Star Trek anymore, which I think is why the new Star Trek series, even though I'm not a fan of it, is based back in the prime universe and not in the offshoot where the movies are happening. It's because people can't go anywhere with it because it's just stupid James Bond / Fast and Furious stuff.
You know, I as someone who is the opposite and not a Star Trek fan at all, not that I dislike it, I actually, anything I've seen of it, I enjoy. There's just so much of it that is daunting to jump onto. Mm. I watched Star Trek Beyond last summer, whenever that came out, 2 summers ago. Didn't hate it, but I do see exactly what you're saying when you say that. It was really nothing more than a popcorn movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everything's action, everything's, you know, I think one of the movies opens with them stealing an idol from natives on another planet. It's like, what happened to the Prime Directive again?
That was the second one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just sounds like you're describing the beginning of a Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which I love, but, you know, it doesn't, to me, as someone who doesn't know Star Trek a ton, it probably shouldn't be Guardians of the Galaxy.
Exactly.
So.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the current iteration. That was what the problem was, is that, oh, let's bring back Star Trek. And they rebooted it in a very Star Trek way, which was cool, by doing an alternate timeline. But then it quickly devolved into, well, what movies are popular and what do people like? And who cares about all the Star Trek stuff that Gene Roddenberry set up? Like, let's throw all that away and just do our own thing. And it's just like, well, then that's not Star Trek anymore. You know, it's his own thing, which is kind of like, well, then, okay, well, let's bring Quentin Tarantino in to do one because it doesn't really matter. I guess my problem with it is, though, when you, like, one of two things, you're either going to get a Quentin Tarantino movie that happens to have spaceships in it, or you're going to get a Star Trek movie that doesn't feel at all like a Quentin Tarantino movie. And it would be like, well, then why do it? You know, if Paramount breathes down his neck, it's like, oh, you can't do that with the characters. Oh, you can't have them cursing. Oh, you can't have them killing people, you know, then it'd be like, well, then why do it? You know, just because you love the franchise? It's, you know.
It sounds like it's being set up to be the next one of those breaking stories we hear where X director dropped off X movie.
Yeah. Because
creative decisions.
Well, it'd be like the movie. You ever see AI? The movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's Steven Spielberg's take on Stanley Kubrick. Mm-hmm. So we saw what happened with that, and it really having two different visions collide like that sometimes is not going to really.
Well, maybe
they don't complement each other.
No.
Maybe Spielberg should have said Kubrick never finished this. Because he said he could never find a way to finish it. Maybe he should have been like, yeah, let me leave it at that.
Yeah.
Maybe don't try and one-up one of the best filmmakers of all time.
Exactly.
Not Spielberg, but he isn't Kubrick, so. Yeah.
So, what about, I have to ask you, have you read the book Ready Player One?
Yeah, I have. Okay. Not a huge fan. I think the concept is very intriguing. I enjoy it a lot. My issue with it now. Have you guys read it?
I'm. What is it? 72% into it. Okay. I'm figuring I'm going to finish it tonight and then like get 2 hours of sleep and go to work.
So my big issue with it is, like I said, love the concepts. I was not when I read it, and I read it the year it came out, which had to have been at least 5 years ago, if not more. I was not a fan of the dialogue back then. Reading it, I really disliked like the stream of consciousness style of writing, I guess. It's not traditional stream of consciousness, but it's like vomiting nostalgia and buzzwords and catchphrases onto the page a lot of the time, at least early on in the first half, which kind of turned me off because it just didn't have a flow that I wanted it to have. It read too much like, it kind of to me read like the diary of this character when it wasn't formatted to read like a diary of that character. Does that make sense?
At least
early on.
Yeah, he goes into all the different makes and models of all the equipment he's using half the time, and
right.
it doesn't drive the story.
It's a particular style of writing that just didn't click with me. But I do see why it would click with others. It just wasn't. It wasn't my vibe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I mean, but the nostalgia part I get. Because literally I actually could have solved these riddles myself. I actually solved two. I've solved two of them just by myself because of I literally experienced everything that the guy's written about. I mean, right down to there's this game called Dungeons of Daggerath. I had a trash 80 color computer too, and with the cassette player, and you usually had to do two backups to it because one would never really work out because you're recording. Audio to a tape as your backup, and it has to play it back with an acoustic coupler or you know, just through audio cables. And my mother used to play it too, and she talks about it. It's one of those pieces of nostalgia that very few people even remember, even if they did know about it. And I mean, this is getting around the dialogue problem that you said, the sheer amount of, I mean, it's literally nostalgia soup. There's just like, I can't get over how many things in there I recognize and played. I played Zork. I played Dungeons of Daggerath. I've, you know, all these games, all these movies, the movies too.
Yeah. I think where my hang up was the dialogue. I think that I'm expecting rather to be very impressed by the movie. Because everything you're talking about is the stuff that I loved about it. It was just that dialogue hang-up that I couldn't get past.
So,
I think that the movie... Go ahead.
You're hoping for no voiceovers.
Yeah, I'm hoping... If the whole movie's just voiceover of him reading the book, then we're going to have a problem. But I think that, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the movie, though, if that's where you were leading with it, which I expect it was. Very much looking forward to the movie because, you know, it's Spielberg and also... I love the concept a lot. The trailers look great, too.
Yeah, seeing the DeLorean and the Iron Giant in the same movie is...
Yeah. Yep. All about that.
Cool. Yeah, I guess it appeals to old people like John.
Oh, thank you.
And I think, I think it actually could be one of the bigger movies of this year, like as an underdog, because it's appealing to that generation. But I think with this like faux affinity that a lot of the newer generation has for older stuff, I think you're going to kind of drag everyone into it. I think it could end up being one of those movies a lot like It was, where the nostalgia factor plays into it tenfold more than they would have expected.
You just said something very interesting there. Faux infinity for,
affinity. Yeah.
Affinity. Like, right.
It doesn't always seem genuine to me. It's like the dude who goes to the flea market and buys a copy of Super Mario Brothers 3 for $30 because he saw it once when he was a kid, you know? I think a lot of that is, I saw this Transformer once when I was a little kid. I love Transformers. And I think that a lot of that's going to play into the movie's favor.
So yeah.
Intentional. Yeah, it's not this intentional, malicious, like, fakeness. It's people kind of falling for the nostalgia thing in a way where they'll just bite for it. And I think that that's what's going to work in Ready Player One's favor.
But not people that... Are you talking like the younger generation that didn't experience that stuff?
Okay. Yeah. So not like the older generation will absolutely appreciate it for, you know, they grew up with it. But it's the people maybe... my age range or a little younger that saw some of the stuff growing up, or maybe like their older sibling stuff, and they don't necessarily love it, but it kind of gives them that feeling of nostalgia without actually having experienced the stuff 100%. And I think that's why it played so well to like not just like the late 20-year-olds, but also like the younger kids, because they kind of remember like the feeling of what it was like to know people who were that age in the 80s and 90s.
Well, I mean, I do find that interesting because, I mean, it's 2018. So, you know, your average 20 to 22 year old was born in the very late 90s.
Right.
So, right. They didn't experience any of this stuff. And I couldn't even tell you, I guess Power Rangers, you know, maybe late 90s, early aughts, but I can't even really think of anything that was, you know, the real in thing to those kids. That they would be excited about a movie coming out.
The 80s?
No, not the 80s. The aughts.
Oh, the aughts?
Yeah.
You're talking like if they were to make a Ready Player One for those type of kids, you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
Oh. Gotcha. I mean, the fads then would have been like Beanie Babies and Pokemon and stuff like that.
My God, Beanie Babies.
But Pokemon goes back to the 80s too, doesn't it? I mean.
No, Pokemon's like 95, 96 when that started.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
It just seems that long.
Yeah, okay. It's been a long time, but no, it wasn't quite that long. No, Power Rangers was the early 90s. Pokemon was like 96, 97, probably.
Yeah, that is it. And that's...
But you're right. A lot of that bled into the early 2000s.
Yeah. See, now, that's funny because the current raft of comic book movies are all based on pulling on those chords of nostalgia in people that are like my age that, you know, have... you know, grew up watching like Captain America steal a car in a movie and, you know, Spider-Man, you know, hold his arm out and have somebody throw a web from off screen onto somebody on the film. It's, you know, those of us that have always wished that the movies had been able to, the technology and the graphics and everything could catch up to what we always envisioned in our minds that was going on in the actual comic books. And, you know, I mean, the kids today, they go to this because they're big blockbusters and there's explosions and whatever. But, you know, do you think it's more driven by guys who grew up with comic books and, you know?
So like I said, I think a lot of it, and this comes from like, you know, I've not done official sample size stuff, but I work, you know, 50 hours a week at the theater and I see a lot of the people that are coming in for these movies. And there is a lot of that generation coming in and watching stuff like Thor Ragnarok and Guardians of the Galaxy and a lot of this stuff where it's kind of got that throwback feel to it. You know, all the synth stuff in Thor and how 80s it feels with its colors, that splash and all that stuff. And Guardians of the Galaxy with the soundtrack. I see an equal number, if not more, of a younger generation, not necessarily kids, but like the late teens, early 20s kids, the college kids coming in, loving that stuff and a lot of the stuff they're talking about. And this part maybe comes from more my employees than anybody else, talking about how they love that quote unquote old school vibe to it. So that's even these kids that weren't even, like you said, they were born in the late 90s. They didn't even come close to experiencing it. For whatever reason, that is still nostalgic to them. I can't quite put a finger on why, but that's the stuff I'm talking about. And it was the same thing with It. They loved how, oh, that felt like it was like when I was growing up, except they were that age in 2006. I think that for some reason, I can't put my finger on it, that nostalgia from that 80s and 90s period works for everyone still. And I think eventually we're going to grow out of it, but I think it still is working. And I don't know if it's because they still grew up on reruns from that time, because if you think about like the rerun cycle, shows from the 80s and 90s still would have been running pretty regularly into the mid-2000s to late 2000s. I don't know if that's what it is, but there is a very heavy demographic of late teens, early 20s watching these movies that love it for that quote-unquote old-school vibe.
I mean, I could see that. I'm confused by it, too, because, like, you know, I have a, my daughter is 23 and my son's 16, and, like, I've sat down and watched older movies with them, but they're not, they don't sit there and go, oh, the nostalgia feel, you know, with that stuff.
Yeah, and I don't know that even going back and watching those older movies themselves would give those kids those vibes. It's the newer movies that do it. Because, like, I tried to do a movie night with some of the kids from work sometimes where I put on, like, an old movie for them, just some of the crew that would come show up. Half the time they asked me to I tried to show them Clerks once, and they all groaned when they saw it was in black and white.
Oh, jeez.
But these are the same kids that would say the quotes that I was just giving you guys.
Yeah.
So it is this bizarre, I like I said, can't put my finger on it, but that's kind of my sample size of seeing where these movies hit people.
So the kid who's always going, I'm not even supposed to be here today, groans when he sees Clerks as in black and white.
Yup, exactly. That was one of my most groan-inducing moments, was an auditorium full of like 20 of the employees groaning and asking me to put something else on because Clerks was in black and white, me and one other manager pleading with them to give it a shot.
I remember one night, probably going back four or five years ago, we decided, oh, let's watch Goonies. And thinking, my son, he's 12 years old. He's the perfect age to watch this movie. And he's watching. He's like, it's really old.
Yeah. I remember trying to do that with one of my cousins with Gremlins a couple of years ago. He was younger, wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, but, even when that was released, Gremlins was weird. So,
But I will be honest, it is a little tough to go back and watch Goonies as an adult and be like, yeah, this movie is such an 80s movie.
Well, half the soundtrack is Cyndi Lauper, so.
There was a different way of editing movies back then. Like, a lot of felt like, I won't say jump cuts, but like just stuff felt uneven sometimes, and it's like, you know, like sometimes you'd have like the car driving by and you'd have a voiceover of the people in the car so they could explain something that leads up to like a joke or a gag in the next scene, you know, like a lot of that kind of stuff. just pay attention to some 80s movies. You'll notice stuff like that. And it's just like, yeah, they don't make them like this anymore for a reason.
I'd have to go back and find some pure examples, but I definitely know when I've gone back and watched some older stuff, there's also stuff what you just reminded me of where like the voiceovers and cars. I feel like there was so much less spoon fed to you in those movies. And I don't mean that in like a nostalgia, it was better back that way, but like in the sense where not always in a good way, because they'll just jump from scene to scene and assume that you figured out what was going on.
Yes.
There wasn't as much smoothness in the editing. It would just kind of cut between scenes. And I notice that sometimes when I'll watch older movies where it's just, oh, we're here now. Okay.
Right. Exactly. I don't want to be spoon fed, but I don't want you to jump, you know, to the next morning with no explanation of what's going on.
Find the middle ground.
Yes. Yeah.
And nowadays, if you go to CinemaSins on YouTube, one of the biggest sins he's got is, you know, narration and reading.
Yeah.
So we need to get back to that where we don't need to be spoon-fed. We're sci-fi people. We're geeks. We know what's going on. We're smart. We can figure it out.
Sometimes.
if it's a good movie.
Wow, we've been a little over an hour now talking. Do you have any other projects coming up that you want people to keep an eye out for?
As of right now, you know, we just have Sinitis coming out, but Cody and I are working on a few other things. We don't know when we're gonna be trying to push them out there. So as of right now, we'll just leave it with Sinitis.
Okay.
We're gonna kind of push that over the next few months. hopefully, you know, once issue one comes out, we can talk about it a little more without trying to spoil issues two and three. but yeah, for now, just tinnitus. And I hope you guys are happy with all the information I gave you on the issue today.
Oh yeah. I'll just have to go over this again and again to make sure I've got it all.
You don't want to miss any of it. Yeah. make some footnotes.
So then here's the very first important question near the end. What is the best way for people to get their hands on this book once it comes out?
So you can still pre-order. It did sell out for initial pre-orders on Diamond for issue one the other day. But you can order it directly through the Alterna website. Stores can order it directly through the Alterna website. If you follow Alterna on Twitter, you'll see some links that Peter has put up to order it directly through him. Otherwise, you should be able to, once we get some more shipments out to Diamond, you should be able to still pre-order it through your local comics shop. We also do have Zenitis on some newsstands. Some other Alterna books, just to plug for some other, more of the kid-friendly Alterna books, are actually found in some Barnes & Nobles around the country as well. Not Zenitis, a little more horror-based, a little bit more graphic in some parts. But some of the kid-friendly Alterna books, which I highly recommend, are actually found in Barnes & Noble.
Cool.
So he's got a good reach out there.
And are you guys going to be at any conventions coming up?
As of right now, Cody and I have talked. I think we're trying to potentially go to the Granite State Con. I have these dates on another computer, so I am not professionally prepared for this. But I do have a Word document on my desktop computer that has these dates in it that we are potentially doing. I know Boston Comic Con, I'm getting married this year, and Boston Comic Con is actually the weekend of my wedding, so we will not be doing that one, or I will not be doing that one. I have tinnitus.
Priorities, Dan, priorities.
But yeah, as much as I tried to get my fiance to move the wedding so that I could go to Boston Comic Con and pitch my book, she was not having it.
You could get married at the convention.
I didn't think about that, and I'm gonna run that by her right after this. I think I know the answer already.
We have a good friend of the show, Rusty Gilligan, who's an ordained minister, and he does marry people at conventions.
Outstanding. I will see what she has to say about that. I bet the answer is totally not no.
So. All right, then. And what is the best way for people to find you online?
So you can follow me on Twitter at whatamaneuver, which is, I'm going to spell it for you, because it's based off the old Vince McMahon catchphrase when he would do commentary in WWF in the 90s, where he would just yell, "What a maneuver," when someone did something. So it's whatamaneuver. What a maneuver.
Okay.
And that's on Instagram and Twitter.
Cool.
We'll add that to our description on,
perfect,
on the site. And links. Yes.
Cool. And question we normally like to wrap up on. I don't remember if I asked this in the online interview, actually, which I probably did, but I'm going to ask again anyway for our listeners. How do you measure success?
I believe we did answer that in the interview. And I think I kind of had I didn't have a super confident answer at the time either, but on the fly right now, I would say, you know, as long as you're balancing everything, that's what's important to me. And that's, I said in the interview that Cody kind of keeps me in check with that, because I try to balance, you know, work and relationships and writing, in a way that keeps me sane, and that means that I don't necessarily write as much as I should, but I'm sane, and that's what matters to me. So I think success and all that is all based on your own personal comfort level and what you are able to do without, you know, burning yourself out and killing yourself.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And the fact that you did not bite on having Rusty marry you at Boston Comic Con shows that you do have one foot in the sane door, so that's good.
Hey, listen, I didn't say I'm not doing it. I just got to run it by her, and I'm still on board on my half.
Oh, okay.
I'm gonna throw her under the bus when I don't do it.
Nice.
All right, Rusty, well, you'll be heading up to Boston to perform a wedding, it sounds like. And I know he's listening, because he actually messaged me on Friday saying he really enjoyed our first episode of the year, which was out last week. So I know he's listening.
All right. You're going to marry. I'll get back to you.
All right.
I'll let you know what she says.
Cool. All right. If you don't have anything else to add, I think that's a good place to put a pin in it for this week.
Perfect. No, I got nothing else. I appreciate you guys having me on. I know I wasn't able to give a ton away about the book, but I definitely appreciate you guys' support and letting me talk about it to the extent that I can.
Well, we look forward to when it comes out.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. We'll most likely do a review on the website. That would be handled by our very own Matt Froom. And he'll try to review it without giving too much away. How's that?
I appreciate that.
Cool. Well, on that note, boys and girls, as always, thanks for listening. And don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.